will come to order. What I'd like to start out with, and we're not going to go real long today because the chairman has another conference committee to confer, is to go through the system directives for Minsky and the University of Minnesota. And the Senate does have a couple of directives. The House has quite extensive directives. So I think everyone is kind of capable of reading through them, so it seems like a waste of our time if we kind of staff go over them. So maybe we should start with just hearing from guests in the audience today. Thanks, welcome. Just hearing from Minsky, first of all, and I think we did have a handout on what their preference was. These two bills, maybe you could comment. Let's hear from Minsky that can comment on the system directives in the House and Senate bill.
Good morning, Chair Pappas and members of the Conference Committee. My name is Judy Borgen with the Minnesota State College and University. Yes, there are a number of directives for the system within particularly in the House, much more specific directives than there are in the Senate. I guess that we feel that you are in charge of approving our Board of Trustees that are appointed, and that it is really the work of the Board of Trustees along with the Chancellor and the system leadership to determine how we spend the appropriation that we receive from you. So we would appreciate having a few specific directives that take away that flexibility from the Board and the leadership of the system to determine.
Ms. Borgen, it seems like in among legislators, and I think particularly in the House as evidenced in their bill, there seems to be kind of an ongoing debate about the role of the central office as opposed to, you know, what is the job of the campuses. Could you talk to us a little bit about, you know, what the central office does and specifically what the central office does for the campuses?
Well, certainly, Madam Chair and members of the committee, the system office is sort of, it certainly has a policy role in determining the things that the legislature and the law delegates to the system. They do set some number of board policies, so that is one of the roles. The Chancellor is the administrative leader of the system, and he directs the presidents and the senior staff within the system. We, however, have a large portion of the activity of the Office of the Chancellor that deals with what we call our shared service area, where we actually do activities on behalf of the system as a whole to try to gain efficiencies in a system as large as ours. We certainly can do some things centrally that make more sense than to have 32 institutions doing something differently and then having to try to gather together those things centrally. So certainly our IT is enterprise technology is one of the areas where we do most of much more of a centralized activity. We have a Office of General Counsel, along with using the Attorney General's Office, that provides legal assistance to our institutions. Certainly it is, we hope, more effective to have expertise here and to be able to use the Attorney General's Office's expertise rather than having attorneys interpreting things and having to be located at each one of our campuses. We also have things like certain accounting services. We have a loan collection area where we collect at the request of the institutions if they would like to have us do loan collection, kind of be that collection agency that goes out when students don't pay their loans, to go out and work with students on payment plans and getting that done. and some many of our institutions have decided to use that service. It is something that they want to do that locally, they can. So there's kind of a continuum of services. There are some things we do. Certainly we negotiate the three faculty contracts that have been delegated to us by Minnesota Management and Budget, faculty contracts that are unique to our system. We do the negotiations of those centrally. We process certain of the grievance up to a certain level. When they're done at the campuses, once they reach a certain level, they come to our office as kind of an appeal process from a campus decision-making process. So it's a continuum of services. Some things we have not a lot of input on, and it's pretty much delegated at the campuses. Other things are done centrally.
Senator Latch.
Madam Chair, I had a conversation with one of the campus institutions. They explained to me that they turn to the central office for expertise on building maintenance issues and repair issues and evaluation of how to handle some of the building issues. Expertise that resides in the central office that's available to all of the campuses that the individual campus simply would not have the resources to have on staff. So, in fact, it saves them money to be able to have an expert in the central office that can provide those services to more than one campus. And it also gives them better decision-making because they've got that expertise available to them.
Madam Chair.
Representative Covina.
Madam Chair, and Senator Latch, I agree with you that the central office in helping some of the smaller campuses particularly can, you know, be more cost-effective for them. But the last time I checked, it was the legislature that created the MCU system. I recall the battle back in the early 90s to bring in the technical colleges into the MCU system, a battle led by the Senate, I might add. We created the system. We fund the system. And last time I checked, I got an election certificate, and we get to tell the system how to use the money we spend. I mean, we give them. Now, you know, 2 years ago, we had some money to spend around here before this whole economic crisis happened. And one example in particular, I think on your spreadsheet, Madam Chair, you had in the tens of millions of dollars for technology for the city. I can't remember, was it 12 million, Doug, or was it, I can't remember, something, 12 million. We had, I think, 28 million or something like that, 20-some million. By the time the system, because we didn't put anything in law, by the time it got to the Board of Trustees, basically, I think former Representative McElroy and former Senator Benson said, well, they can't tell us what to do. We're going to take $60 million. Even though Ms. King, I don't know if she's here today, talked to me up in Mesabi when she was up there on a visit with one of their lobbyists, Mr. Janicic, a former senator, that can we take 40? Well, you know, that's twice as much as we had and three times as much as the Senate had. But if you're going to use it wisely, tell me you're going to do, okay, 40 went to 60. Why don't we just go home? Here, we'll just give the university $600 million and we'll give the system $600 million and we'll go.
They would like that.
They'd love it. But I'm not going to do that because I have a responsibility to these kids that are sitting out there in the audience and to my constituents who are paying the bill to see that this money is used wisely. And this debate should happen in this room and on the floor of the House and Senate. Now, Senator Latch, I agree with you that the central office can be very cost effective by doing certain things out of the office. That's not the debate in the House. My members will tell you the debate is other things that the central office is doing, like awards of excellence and centers of excellence and, you know, the technology issue is one. So you know, I don't think that anything we did in here had anything to do with the academic portion of the system. I'm not telling anybody, unlike we both are in this bill with the university and stem cell research, or cloning. Incidentally, I think, you know, maybe a few more of me and Phyllis Kahn should be cloned by the university. But, you know, aside from that, wouldn't you like that, Senator Rubin? Huh?
I think
are you catching your breath?
I think we only need one of a kind.
But we're not telling the system what to do with, you know, how they teach, and we're telling them what to do with the money that we appropriate so that, to the best of our ability, it is used wisely for the sole purpose of what MinSU and the university, what I think exists for, and that is to educate our population to do good things and to get good jobs and to better themselves and be productive citizens. So,
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Bukadina. I'm sensitive, frankly, to comments made by Senator Lash and the comments made by Representative Bukadina, and it's my understanding that those concerns just on the central office in general, I think are far greater than outside of the higher ed jurisdiction and outside of this conference committee. My understanding that the Office of the Legislative Auditor is looking at ideas of things that they might want to take a look at next year. And, Ms. Borgen, maybe you can comment. I'm under the impression that both the board and the chancellor are supportive of having the central office be one of the things that the OLA takes a look at. I wonder if you could comment on that, Borgen.
The possible items to be selected, and the fact that we've had great support from many legislators as getting that to be almost the top priority in terms of what the OLA is going to be looking at next year. We are going to be having that, and they have already come and had their kind of entrance conference with us, so they'll be getting work on that immediately. I think their timeline is to have something to you toward the beginning of your next session.
Senator Lash.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, with all due respect, I don't see us as the Board of Trustees for MinSU. I mean, there's certain things that we go through by selecting and appointing and screening and approving nominations for the Board of Trustees, and then we have an obligation, I think, at some point to delegate responsibility to them to do the job. We did memorialize in statute, or at least in session law, money that was designated for Centers of Excellence or other things, and we've done that. I don't know what the House debate was over, you know, maybe the conclusion is now that money was misspent, but the legislature directed MinSU to spend, you know, certainly at least appropriated to them money for Centers of Excellence, and I think there were like six different special categories that it was specified for. But at some point, I think we have to have some confidence in the administration that they're making some judgments, and the Board of Trustees in particular, and the chancellor, that they're making some appropriate judgments as to how best to run that system. The legislature and its wisdom put that system together and established the Board of Trustees and established the management mechanism. I don't think we're the managers, and I don't think any of us is best suited to be able to really fully evaluate what the precise proportion is that's best between central office and the various campuses. I understand the political pressures on that. There's probably a campus in almost every legislator's district. And every campus faculty, not mine, and apparently not Senator Biden, maybe we're the only three agents in the room from that standpoint. But, you know, every campus, every faculty that's there, every administrator, they chafe at being told what to do by a central office. But the fact is there are advantages and efficiencies that come from having a central office, and if you're going to manage your system, you've got to manage it from the top. You do it appropriately with input and everything else, but at some point the buck stops with the managers that we hire, right? The Board of Trustees and through them the chancellor. If we don't like what they're doing, certainly we have a right to give our input, or we have a right to not reappoint the trustees that we don't think are doing the job right. But I think, frankly, there's a lot of stuff in this bill that is flat-out micromanaging, at least in the House side of it. We've tried to avoid that in the Senate side, including giving specific direction to the exact proportions of where the cuts have to be made in terms of central office versus campuses. You tell them, we're going to cut you all this whatever the cut's going to be, but you can't take it out of you, you can't take it out of there, and you can't take it out of there. And by the way, you're cutting off your potential revenue sources because you can't raise tuition either. We're giving them absolutely no tools to manage the dilemma that we're putting them in. So I think there are twofold questions here. You know, I'm touching on the tuition cap issue as well, but more importantly for the premise of this comment, is that we are not the Board of Trustees, and I think it would be a misappropriation of authority for us to act like the Board of Trustees. If we don't like what they're doing, we don't have to reappoint them.
Madam Chair, we don't have that opportunity. You guys rubber stamp who gets suggested. I don't think you've ever refused one. We don't get to vote on appointments to the Board of Trustees. You do. Senator Lass, am I doing anything illegal in this bill by telling the Board of Trustees? Do I have the authority? Do we as a legislature have the authority to tell them what to do and where to spend money? What I am doing, is there anything illegal here? Unconstitutional here?
Senator Lass.
Representative Rukavina, it's not a question of illegal or unconstitutional. It's the question of what do we think is the appropriate role of the legislature. And it's a policy question, and we have a disagreement on the policy approach we should take.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Senator Lass, you're an attorney. Do you ever introduce legislation that tells the courts or what to do or tells anybody what to do? In that regard, I think you've introduced legislation that tells the courts or directs them to do things or certain institutions within the legal system.
Madam Chair, I've certainly introduced bills to change the laws with regard to what governs, you know, the statutes in Minnesota. But in terms of the funding stuff, I don't know that I've specifically introduced a bill that directs the courts to do anything, no, or tells them exactly how they're going to have to spend their money.
Well, the point being, Madam Chair, you introduce bills that tell the court system what to do. They're a separate branch of government. But you still have the authority to do it, and you exercise that authority as a senator. We're exercising our authority. That's all we're doing. You may have a different philosophy. We're closer to the people. We door knock every 2 years. You guys get smarter every 4 years.
I think it may be a matter of degree and specificity. That may be a little, you know, a little too much micromanaging. I think we're all guilty of telling the systems to do certain things. We have some things in our bill we told them to do, or you don't have to do anymore. And maybe we should recede from that. Who's got their cell phone by a microphone?
Thank God is calling me here.
Please remove it. Okay. Well, I think sometimes if you have it too close, it makes sense.
Could we hear from, maybe we should hear from the students and the people in the trenches, the teachers. Maybe I see one of the representatives from the two-year system, and there's one from the four-year system. Maybe we should ask them, too. They're actually the people that teach our students. Can we ask them what they think of the
outcome? Of course we can. Mr. Stanton, would you like to come forward?
Mr. Nelson's over there.
Mr. Nelson. Anyone else is welcome.
Chair.
I am.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Russ Stanton, Interfaculty Organization, State University Faculty Union. We're very supportive of the House position on most things, not all of those, including with the rider language. Particularly, we're interested in the separate line item for the system office. I mean, the practice has been, I've been around here a long time, ever since Minsky was created, the practice has been to give about $600 million to the central office, and then it's up to the central office to decide how much they keep and how much they pass on to the campuses. And not surprisingly, over the years, what has happened is more and more stays in the central office and less gets to the campuses where actual instruction takes place. And we have gotten to a situation, and I would just point out to your own budget document that you got from Minsky, that the front page says the core mission or the core function of Minsky is teaching and learning. But if you look at how much of the money goes to instruction, direct classroom instruction, it's 40%. Now, if we were the University of Minnesota or, you know, some other institution that had a big research mission or whatever, maybe that would be an acceptable percentage. But for a system that's core function is classroom instruction, I think we need to pay attention and assure that the money gets out to the campuses for them to spend. The central office has grown a lot. I would point out,
Mr. Stanton, we just need to know, have they taken on more functions, though, with the money? That, have they taken functions away from the campuses in the process?
Where the growth has occurred in the central office has primarily been in the technology groups. I mean, 2007, the expenditures for MINSCU for instructional, for, I shouldn't say it's instructional technology, it's all, it's, in fact, very little that goes to online education. But the money that was being spent, was the base, was $21.5 million. That jumped in 2008 to $46 million, I believe it was. And then there was a cut last time, you took $5 million out. But we're still dealing with expenditures for that function of more than 100% of what they were just 2 years ago. And so it's those types of functions. Now, if it was money to support online education, I think faculty would be, our faculty do a lot of online education. A lot of them like doing online education. But, you know, some of it is for things like MINSCU Island. Have any of you ever gone to MINSCU Island? Has there ever been a credit delivered through MINSCU Island? Some of it is for dashboards, where they have these little dashboards that show how we're doing. Have any of you ever gone online and, first of all, tried to get the dashboards? It's almost impossible. And when you get there, you'll find out that several of the dials don't work. And when you look what's behind the dials, it's pretty simple kind of stuff. A lot of money went into that. So we're questioning the priorities of the money that gets stuck in the central office and the money getting out to the campus. If you go back to 2003 and look at how much money was being allocated out to the campuses by the allocation formula, where they get to prioritize it, where the campuses get to decide what do we spend on it, we were spending more dollars than we are right now going out to the campuses via the allocation formula. Mm. When I say now, I'm talking about after the deallocation that occurred this last time. We're headed into some pretty severe cuts. I mean, we know, even if we get saved by the federal money this time, 2 years from now, there's got to be some big adjustments made, and there's going to be some layoffs occurring. I guess our interest is that the central office take a fair share of that, and that we protect basic classroom instruction. Last time when we had $20 million deallocated in December, what the central office did when they spread that $20 million cut is they took a percentage of the total budget to the campuses, including tuition, but only a percentage of parts of the central office functions, and applied that percentage. And as a result, when you look at, because the central office doesn't have tuition, and the campuses do, that meant the campuses took a bigger percentage cut of their appropriations than the central office did. And not only that, but they exempted parts of the central office. We kind of play a game of what the central office really is. Sometimes it's, they refer to it as just the chancellor and the shared services. Sometimes it's total system-wide set-aside.
Doesn't it include the salaries of the presidents, too?
Yes, the salaries of the presidents used to be sent out to the campuses. Now they pulled that into the central office. So I guess our concern is by establishing a dollar figure of how much the central office gets to spend and how much goes out to the campuses. You supply at least some legislative control over how much money gets out to the campuses. And frankly, I don't think that's micromanaging. I mean, why have democracy? Why elect legislators if you don't provide some direction to how things get run?
Mr. Nelson. Thank you, Mr. Stanley. Why don't you stay there and take their questions?
Rick Nelson from the Minnesota State College.
Mr. Nelson. Secretary Covina.
If you don't mind if I ask a question before you talk to you.
Don't give me any more of your cold.
Okay. Why, was I getting a little close to you the other night, or what?
No problem.
What would that pie chart look like back in 2002, as far as the instruction percentage, do you know?
I couldn't. I think it'd be more, but I couldn't tell you.
Maybe Ms. Bargen can tell us that.
Okay, Mr. Nelson.
Rick Nelson from the Minnesota State College faculty, and for the most part we agree with what Mr. Stanton and the IFO has said, basically that protecting the core mission of teaching and learning and what MINSTE is about is where our priorities are, what's taking place in the classroom. As far as the bill goes, making sure that the colleges are whole so we can continue to offer the courses and provide the mission. You heard yesterday the enrollment numbers, what's happening at the two-year college levels. We're a little concerned from that perspective. Not only the federal stimulus money will save us now, but 2 years from now, what's going to happen in that regard? And so without reiterating everything Mr. Stanton said, that we just want to make sure that we've protected the teaching and learning and providing those opportunities for students.
Ms. Stanton?
Yeah, when I said at the beginning that we supported the rider language, there's some things. Well, first of all, we like the Senate rider language in terms of doing away with the mandates or unfencing the money and so forth. I think that's an important thing. It gives flexibility. One part of the House language that we don't think makes sense, and that is the part that you can't fill managerial spots. Those freezes,
mm-hmm.
I don't think are ever a good idea. Give you a good example. Bill Cheeda is moving on as head of, vice chancellor of human resources. Are you just going to leave that vacant? I mean, it has to be filled. I think it would hold the resources and let them decide whether they fill the position. So.
I in the proposal I did to the Senate yesterday, we took that.
Okay,
language.
Okay, thank you.
I don't know if that's kind of that's
so. Thank you, Representative Covina. I wanted to get some more input from people before I responded to your proposal there, because I think some of the things you're talking about, which indicate legislative intent, I too share your concern about technology, and I would actually like to have a chart from MINSTE on how technology money was spent. You know, how much went to campuses and how you spent the money, because I don't know if we ever got that. We did get a chart in the House bill. You were concerned about how they spent the money to serve non-traditional students that are unrepresented. And we did get a chart on how that money was spent, and it did go to the campuses. And I think that's good for us to know that. If we could, Todd, you want to pass out this chart? It's a little hard to see. But it went through on every campus.
And I think that's what I said.
Yeah. It went to every campus on an allocation formula, but then it also went to, they picked a couple centers of excellence for these issues. So I did have staff make copies of that. Mm-hmm. And you limited their expenditures to $5 million for the biennium. Currently they have $11 million a year, I think, in that area.
What we did is say that money would be allocated to the campuses in the same term.
So it is currently allocated to the campuses, except for three campuses get Access Centers of Excellence, Inver Hills, Minnesota State Community and Technical College. I don't know where that is. Which minister?
Moorhead, Burgess Falls, Detroit Lane.
Oh, that's several of them.
Yeah.
Okay, that's several colleges. And St. Cloud State University. They got special grants based on, I think, a competitive process. But most of the money did go out on an allocation formula. I actually was a little concerned about that because I wondered if they were using it just to backfill their existing staff, but I believe they did use it to expand services. So I hope that was the case, and that's my understanding that was the case. Let's see, what else? So some of these things, we are sympathetic to you, and some things we think have gone a little too far, like freezing the vacancies, and does anybody else in the room want to comment on this central office issue in the room? Anybody on your side want to comment on the central office? Any of the students want to? Okay, then let's... tuition caps, I think we've touched on that a little bit. We're going through the short side by side. I was under the impression, this is 3%, that the discussion you had with Minsky was that their intention is to buy down with stimulus money their tuition to 3%. I think your bill says 2. This is wrong.
2 years.
But you realize it's just 2% on R14.
It wasn't my, that wasn't the discussion that I had with the head in my office. I think I said 5 and 2, and I think there was staff in there that heard me say 5 and 2. And
can we hear from Minsky on what your opinion is on the tuition cap?
Before Ms. Gordon starts, if you could comment on the price chart, too.
Where is the price chart?
Do you know what that price chart is?
It's in your budget book.
You got it right out of your budget.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, right, the chart that you have is reflective of all funds, and 40% amount is what we spend when we include our revenue fund, all of our auxiliaries, the amount that we get in federal financial aid, all of those funds together, when you look at that, instruction becomes a smaller portion of our total expenditures. When you look at just our general fund expenditures, which is what year's appropriation along with the student's tuition and other fees that we collect, then it's about 50% of what we spend. When you add in academic support to that, which is really the kind of the area where we are in terms of supporting the academic area, it would be the academic computing, it would be our libraries and those kinds of things, we come up around 60, a little over 60% of our total spending within the general fund itself. If you're looking at all funds, though, the 40% is correct in terms of the instruction when you add in these other funds to support our activities.
If we go back a decade, what does this pie chart look like?
That I cannot tell you. I would have to go back to Representative Griffin and find that. I certainly, we can do that if you would like.
I'd like to see.
And if that is the cost driver of this technology, and I think we do need to know what's the value added. I know that I teach part time in the ministry system. I'm a community faculty at Metro State, and I know that faculty and students do require technology to be available really 24/7. I mean, you have students who are studying late at night; they want the computer to be operational so that they can get information. Faculty, I had this. I think I explained this to my committee, but I had this problem when I was trying to do my grades for my class in the fall. When I went to do my grades after my last class at 10 o'clock at night, I was leaving on a plane to Israel the next day at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and my PIN number didn't work for whatever reason. So I couldn't get to figure out my PIN number until the next morning, and the next morning the computers were down at Metro State. And I said to them, well, how am I going to do my grades? I don't want to leave it for Israel because the technology there isn't that reliable. And she said, well, you could just fax me the grades. which meant I had to type all the students' names and their grade. And in the meantime, I'm trying to transfer a car and pack and get ready to leave and everything else. So luckily, I did everything else, and by noon, the computers were back up. So then I could just go through, and I had the student's name. I just had to plug in A, B, C, failed. I didn't fail anybody. And it was very slick when it worked. But it is true that we do rely on that, and how much of that do we need the technology that comes out of the central office to back up what we're doing on the campus, and how much was that the Metro State computers were down, and whose fault was that? It's kind of a long story, but I guess the point. The students and faculty really need that new technology.
Madam Chair, and what I might also say is it isn't only online that our technology supports. It's also the registration of the student. We have now the online registration. We have online payment so that you can go online and pay your bill. You don't have to stand in line at the business office anymore if you want to pay for your classes. There's a lot of things that the technology that the system has supports in terms of student access as well. And certainly, I think, I don't know if Senator Pappas, you have it in your class, but certainly a class, whether it's online or on ground, has a lot of technology in it.
I had a smart classroom,
yes.
And it was really cool because we could go on the internet and we could watch all the Saturday Night Live spoofs on Sarah Palin and all the other candidates.
Yeah.
My students really enjoyed that. I don't know about the academic value, but we have a lot of
fun. Senator Pappas, those are the kinds of things that the technology and the increase in those costs are supporting. It's also those kinds of enhancements and having more of that kind of access available. It used to be that you had one or two classrooms where you had that, and now we're trying to get that more and more out. And that's what the technology money both supports and also the connectivity, the infrastructure behind all of that allows for it to not crash during, hopefully when you're posting your grades next time, we'll have better infrastructure down below that so that it won't be a problem.
Any other questions for Ms. Forgan right now? So we're back to, we were talking a little bit about the tuition limits. Do you want to comment on that?
Yes, Madam Chair. In terms of the tuition limits, of course, we would like to have that, you know, available for the board to make the decision. If we do have to have what the board has been talking about with institutions, we began when we had a biennial budget request, we were talking about a 4-4 and trying to buy that down with additional support from the state because we are not seeing additional support coming, rather a reduction in our budget. The board is now beginning to talk. They will not make their final tuition decision until the legislature is complete. We're planning for the board to act on the final tuition approval in July. But at this point in time, the planning assumptions that are being used by the institutions and those board members that we have talked to are kind of comfortable with going with a 5-5 with the idea that we would have stimulus funds to be able to reduce that amount for what the students would have to actually pay with some sort of a recognition that we would have a lower tuition rate for the students that we could apply then the stimulus money to still support the campuses with a revenue increase of 5% but have a lesser amount for the students to pay during the next 2 years.
And Ms. Morgan, is that buy down with federal stimulus money dependent on how much federal stimulus money you get?
Madam Chair, yes, it is. If we were to get, because of the way the stimulus money formula is there from the federal guidelines, if a lot of that were to go to be split between higher education and K-12, and we were to get very little, I think that we would then put that out unrestricted. The campuses, it would be for the campuses to decide if they would use it to not perhaps raise their tuition rate as much or that they would use it for just their operational kinds of one-time things as they're trying to move their base down to 2012. But hoping that we have sufficient money so far to be able to do at least, we've been talking about a 2% or a 3% buy down in the first year if we were to go a 5%, and something like 2% in the second year.
Well, so I think there might have been some confusion between the 2% buy down or a 3% increase.
Instead of 3%
buy down, equal to 2%. Yes.
Which is what we have in the bill.
Right.
You know, Madam Chair, we should probably have a discussion here about, you know, I can't blame the systems for the predicament they're in. Maybe once in a while they spend money that, at least I think the legislature didn't intend them to expend it on. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that when you were the chair and you couldn't help it back in 2003, I believe it was, you cut 320?
I didn't even vote for my own bill.
Was it 320, Mr. Burke, out of the system? 380 out of the system. And, you know, that's been Governor Pawlenty, that's been, where there's no new tax pledges. You know, Sarah Palin took his job without making a pledge, so I don't know why he can't just back off on it and help us with some revenue, because if he doesn't give us some revenue, and I think you have, what, a little over $2 billion, $2.5 billion, what do you have in your tax bill?
$1.5 billion the house?
No, we have,
$2.2 billion,
and we have $1.5 billion, and everything's based on that, and if that doesn't happen, these people representing the students and the younger people in the audience are going to see 10 times, you know, they're going to see huge tuition increases. So I'm not blaming the system, but because they took that $380 million cut, and I don't even know today if they're actually up to the actual dollar amount that they got 6 years ago. I don't know. It's probably a little more, but not much. And yet inflation has eaten everything away and everything else. So I'm not blaming the system. You know, I'll directly blame the governors. No new tax pledge. The economy's terrible. We're getting the American Recovery Act money. And I just, you know, and I talked to the central office and to the university about using some of those funds if we are lucky enough to get the numbers we have for the stimulus money, which I know you like, that we have that money, that they use some of it to keep the students' tuition on. That's what I was trying to do. And some of the other things that you might not agree with on the Senate side, we're just trying to take money that we think maybe the awards of excellence. I don't think the teachers really care for them anymore. They don't think it's a good idea, and take that money and allocate it back out to the campuses so that the students in the end benefit. And I just want to be on the record being clear about the fact that I'm not blaming the systems, because they took a huge hit back in 2003 that they've never recovered from. And, you know, we've cut government and we're just hurting society. And I shudder to think if we don't get the revenue we're both trying to raise, what's going to happen, not just to students, but to some of the most vulnerable people in our society, that, you know, people that can't help the situation, that are medically and mentally handicapped or mentally ill, and, you know, therefore, by the grace of God, go I. And, you know, I know some of you think I'm crazy, but at least I can control it most of the time. So, you know, I mean, there are people that are just so much less fortunate than all of us that are going to suffer. And, you know, the governor's got to make some movement here and think about compromising, and he just can't have his way all the time. Sorry, I got off on a tangent.
It's a good tangent.
Senator Roebling, do you agree with me?
I sit here and I'm concerned about these young people, too. And I want them to have jobs when they graduate from college. And I want our job creators to stay here and grow here. And I'm worried that we push too hard on the other side. They won't be doing that. We already have seen evidence that they're not doing that. And I don't want that trend to continue. I don't want to drive them away from here with higher taxes and regulations. And I really want opportunities for young people here. And, you know, the stimulus package is wonderful, but they're going to pay for it. and it's coming down on their backs because that's just the way it's set up. It's not. It's even the president knows that right now he cannot raise taxes to take care of that stimulus package because he knows what a drag on the economy that would be. So I guess that, you know, there's two sides to this argument.
Well, Madam Chair, Deputy Riccadina, Senator Roebling, our parents and grandparents didn't shirk their responsibility of paying taxes and fair taxes, and we had one of the best education systems in the United States of America. My dad said in World War II, when their offices and that found out people were from Minnesota, they put them in positions of authority because they knew the kind of education system that they received here. And, you know, that's why anywhere you went in this country, until recently, if you were from Minnesota, you know, people knew that you had a good education. And I'm just afraid that it's deteriorating because of no new tax breaks, that's all. We all got to pull on the oar together, and, you know, I wanted to see, I respect your bill. I think your tax bill is much better than ours. It's a good Democratic farmer labor bill. I like the principle of basing taxes on the ability to pay, so... You know, I have to commend the university.
Also share the pain.
Well, I'm at it. I have to commend the university because they're kind of, you know, with the middle income scholarship and that, they're kind of using that principle and helping those with lesser income by charging those with more of an income a little more. So, with that.
Hey, Les.
Madam Chair, I agree with almost everything that Representative Riccadina said. You know, I was around in 2003. It was my first year, and yeah, the $380 million was a devastating blow. And the trend, unfortunately, except for a little bit of backfilling, has not been good. We've been disinvesting in our human infrastructure in Minnesota at all the educational levels, and there's nothing more fundamental to our long-term economic success than making that investment in that human capital. And so it seems to me, and the reason people come here to Minnesota for jobs, and we've got a net inflow of people coming here, is because of the quality of life we provide, the education we provide for their kids, the higher education opportunities, the research that is thrown off from all of that educational opportunity, and the other aspects of the quality of life that we build as a result. It's no surprise, it's no mistake that we have 18 or 19 Fortune 500 companies based in Minnesota, and homegrown. Because of what we have done here. People don't come here for the weather, they come here for other reasons. You know, that said, we've got an obligation, I think, to do what we can to fund the institutions. But when we can't, because we've got a governor that's unwilling to consider new revenues, has been, we wouldn't be in this position if even when the economy was stronger, the governor had been willing to bring in more revenues and we wouldn't have created some structural imbalances. We started out this budget cycle knowing we were $2 billion in the hole because we had done shifts and other structural imbalances to solve past problems because we weren't able to bring in revenues to deal with it. And so our problem this year is that much worse because of we avoided the hard decisions, or at least the governor, in my judgment, avoided those tougher decisions in the past. We've had a premise that we were going to pass on essentially tax increases to the students and their families with tuition increases, and that's how. I mean, I think the governor's been spelling tax TUITION. That was the premise, but if we end up stuck in that position, I don't see how we can legitimately tie the hands of the institutions from the only alternative source of revenue they're going to have. You know, the U can't go out and automatically increase their, you know, their NIH grants, you know, to recover it. So they'll apply for it. But NIMSU does even less in terms of federal funding for their research and their teaching and so on. They're even more heavily dependent on the revenues from the state and from tuition, frankly. So I think it's a good idea to use all the federal stimulus dollars we can to help buy down tuition. I'm reluctant to mandate some of that, but I'm even more reluctant to mandate for us to sit here and decide X percent is the precise amount that is going to help balance the budget in terms of tuition increase, that will balance the budget and balance the needs of the students and of the faculty and of the educational institutions. As much as I regret seeing an increase in tuition, And I borrowed a lot to get myself through college and law school, and I spent a long, many, many years paying back those loans. I will say it was still the best investment I ever made in my own economic future, was to borrow that. That said, I think tuition cap is absolutely the wrong way to go, and in the end, I think that would end up hurting the educational quality that the students would get. You'll end up with perhaps fewer faculty. You'll end up with fewer classes available to be able to meet their track for getting their degree on time. They'll end up having to spend more years in school because they can't get the classes that they need for their majors or whatever their degree is going to be. They'll end up with much larger class sizes, less direct faculty contact, which is important for the educational experience. And the physical infrastructure will be more challenging as well. Whether it's technology or whether it's buildings or whatever it happens to be. Or even all the extra time spent, on enrolling and paying for classes. When I went to college, we all gathered in a large horse barn, an arena, on one end of campus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and when our alphabet came up, we all went to a table, got our registration materials, and it was a race to each department location on campus to get our name on a list so we could get into the classes that we wanted. Now they never go through that. It's just online, boom, they're done. So there are great advantages to that. But, you know, if we're going to start imposing price controls on our campuses, I mean, we've seen what price controls do. They create all sorts of misallocations of resources, distortions of the market, if we're going to talk about, a free market kind of system. But they really tie the hands of the decision makers. And for us, on one hand, to say, we're going to cut your budget, and we're going to tell you, you've got to cut it here and not there, and we're going to tell you, you can't raise revenue. I think that is going overboard. And I, for one, I don't think I'm going to be comfortable signing onto a conference committee report that would include a hard cap on tuition.
That's fair. That's fair to hear.
And I'm not going to sign a conference committee report that doesn't have some kind of tuition cap. Simple as that. I didn't dream this up in the last. I didn't pull these figures out of the air. I brought the president of the University of Minnesota and their lobbying team and their financial team, and I brought the same with the Minsky system, and this is the agreement we reached. You know, we like to talk and communicate with people. We just didn't come up with these ideas. Now, I'm sure there are other things in the bill I didn't communicate with them on. You know, some of the things I had in here about salaries and freezes, although I did talk about freezes and reach an agreement, I thought, with Minsky on some of the technology positions that have never been filled. Those ghost positions, as we call them. Why fill them now in this case, in these economic times, if they're not needed, and if the technology money is going to be reduced, they don't need to be reduced. But I didn't pull these figures out of the air. I sat down with the chancellor, the chancellor's office, the president, university, and the thing they told me they could live with if they get the financial dollars that we have in our bill from the stimulus, from the American Recovery Act.
Okay, are we done with this topic?
Madam Chair, could I request a few things from you?
Mm-hmm.
First of all, could you have maybe, I don't know which senator would be interested, but Representative Bly is interested in working out some differences in our bill on the ag specials.
Okay.
If you could appoint
Senator Ashcroft,
would do that. Okay. And then, could we hear from the students? I think they're a little concerned. They worked long and hard on that 6120 study issue, and I offered it up to you yesterday, and I think they may have some concerns.
Okay.
And they're kind of mad at me, and I don't like it.
It is on our list, but you'd like to have a discussion before you leave.
Yes.
Okay. Why don't you come forward then?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jacob Littler, president of the Minnesota State College Student Association.
My name is Graham Allen. I'm from the Minnesota State University Student Association.
And as Representative Brookavina mentioned, we did have some concerns with the 6120 proposal. We did work very closely with the faculty group, MSCF, specifically with Mr. Nelson and with their president, Greg Mulcahy, to work out some compromise language on how we could address one of the major concerns in that bill, which was the AAS degree. There's been a lot of concern on the campus, both with students and faculty and administrators, as far as how the implementation could affect educational quality and the ability to gain employment after graduation. And so the House language is representative of what we kind of worked out with the faculty and what we think is a good to kind of compromise to implement that. Ms. Graham, do you want to...
I think you know, the differences in the two bills are one in the Senate language. There is a total repealer of language that was established to help or to mandate that Minsky create a policy on working towards the goal of getting for a degree requirement for a university for 120 and for an AA degree. There's been more discussions about AAS and their differences, but at least for an AA. Get to 50 credits. Since it's relatively a standard at higher education institutions. So that's the premise, and the Senate's got a total repealer of establishing that policy. And the House provision has a modification to the AAS language that Jacob just described, with a compromise. I think the end game that we're looking for here is whether it's in law or not. I think we want to work with our trustees. We want to work with our faculty to work on evaluating why are some campuses at 128 credits for a political science degree and why are some at 120. Our contention is after talking with some of the faculty, there might be some differences, but we want to start bringing down those credits where we can. There's always going to be some exemptions and exceptions and some waiver process for special programs and unique programs, you know, things like accounting and medicine, nursing, those kinds of things. There's an it's understood that there needs to be exemptions for those because they need more training and things. What we would like to see is a commitment from I guess the Minsky institutions that they're willing to work for that. And that's our end game. That's what we want to see.
Mr. Haas.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. This appeals process or process to set the semester hours at a higher rate than 16120 seems like it should work. People, I hear differently. What is your opinion? Is it working?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Haas, the full implementation of the waiver process hasn't occurred yet, so it's really hard to specifically say whether or not there's been successes or problems in the process because it just hasn't played out yet. And I think that was one of the major reasons that, you know, we sat down with the faculty group. We understood what their major concerns were, but we also wanted the opportunity to see this process play out and actually see, okay, are there going to be major problems in the waiver process? Is this going to be a boondoggle, or is this something that's actually going to work for students?
To that point?
Mr. Haas.
Then the reactions I'm getting on working and not working are all in the future predictions? Is that what they're telling me? I mean, they're telling me with a great amount of emotion that this is too burdensome, it doesn't work, and some people are telling, well, it should be working really, really well. And so all that is actually people just getting excited about something that they really, truly haven't tried yet?
Again, Madam Chair, Representative Haas, again, my understanding is that the full implementation for end deadline for waivers isn't until June 30th of this year. So, as I said, I don't believe the process is fully played out yet. And again, that's why we brought the language in compromise with the faculty to the House to say, let's allow this to play out, and we'll exempt the AAS degrees right now because we can see that there is clearly major concern on the faculty side, and it could become a student concern if it is going to affect the quality of our education. We all want, especially with the investment that we are making, we want to have a degree that's going to get us gainfully employed. So we want to make sure that's addressed. So let's delay the implementation on that, and move forward with the rest and work out what the issues are between the faculty and students, and allow them to report that back to the committees.
And I think for us, and I'll just kind of read it real quickly. Sorry, my allergies are sure taking me a little.
Hang on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If it's in legislation or not, I'm not sure that the distinction is very big for us. I think what we do want is that this process continues. I know that the Board of Trustees and the Office of Counsel have some concerns about being mandated to do certain things, and we understand that. I think as long as the process can continue to move and that there's, then we're satisfied. We're willing to work with anyone that wants to work on this issue.
Madam Chair, one last point.
Captain Hodge.
I had a document sent to a letter sent to me by a professor and said that this is it's not going to work. Every one of mine have to be above 60. So I would have to appeal this whole curriculum. I'm thinking, what side of the point are you arguing on? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Rukavina, before you leave, I did want us to talk for a minute about the tuition guarantee. So did you have more on this issue?
Well, I was just wondering maybe if Ms. Dixon is the only trustee I see in the room, if she could come up and tell us if we took this out of statute, what would be the policy of the board as far as meeting the concerns of the students. You have a policy in place now that's been worked on for a couple of years. Would that policy then continue to be kept in?
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, my name is Cheryl Dixon, and I am a trustee of the Minnesota State Colleges and University System, and I am one person on the board, and I'm not the chair of the board, so I really can't speak for the board. What I can say about this particular policy is that it was not brought to our attention that it was a problem by the students, and the only time that we heard that it was a problem was when it came to you. And what we would appreciate is to be able to broker these problems, to look them through. What you're hearing at this table is the old story of the elephant. And there are people who see pieces of the elephant, and I certainly understand that. We all see from our own point of view. The board's job is to look at everybody's point of view, and not just the students of today, but the millions of students who are going to want to come to this system in the future. It's our job to keep this system strong so that Minnesota has a system in the future. So we weigh all those things. I really appreciate that this issue has come before you, and I hope it will come back to us, because I think we'll look at it very, very carefully from everybody's point of view, but especially from the point of view of what is the best thing we can do for post-secondary education in Minnesota at this time. So my answer for me is I can't say that it would be a hard and fast policy. I think the idea of waivers is a good one. I think it might put undue burden on some faculty members. And frankly, I haven't had an opportunity to really look at the issue in depth, and I would welcome that opportunity, and I would welcome it for my fellow board members.
Ms. Dixon, do you have a current policy on for all the programs that they have a certain number of credits?
My understanding is that there is a minimum policy at this time. Is that not right, Judy?
I think, Madam Chair, no. Ms. Dixon, I think the board approved the policy about three, 4 months ago.
The board accepted the legislature's legislature's policy, of course.
I don't think it was our policy. I think it was worked out with the teachers and the students and the central office, I thought.
So that was not my understanding. My understanding was that it was initiated by the legislature and that it was brought to us.
Mr. Jacob, do you have
Absolutely.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, the obviously the initial legislative policy came from the legislature and was signed into law. The process of building the Minsky policy did go through a very substantial work group process that involved all stakeholders in the process. Yeah, the waiver process and the actual implementation of the legislation into the system policy. And we had a number of students involved in that from both the four-year and two-year associations, also faculty from the two- and four-year associations.
Madam Chair?
Jackson,
you know, sometimes you shouldn't ask a question that you don't know the answer to, but Mr. Berg, you've been around here a long time, and I think that this issue has been around, and maybe Ms. Novak, that this issue of the 60-120 and 68-128 or whatever for over a decade, and it wasn't until we put something in statute that the board looked at it. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe because I wasn't here on the higher ed committee, you know, a long time ago. But has it been kicked around?
Mr. Chair, members, the health committee certainly has discussed the issue of credit conversion when Minsky was created and semester conversion came up then because there was an opportunity then. I don't believe we've ever had any legislation
that being my point, Madam Chair, is that until we put, they knew this problem was discussed, at least in the House Higher Ed Committee, and until we did something statutorily, it was really not addressed. So, you know, I don't know if I feel comfortable now with the answer from Ms. Dixon, because it wasn't that direct. I'd like to.
I know Senator Lacey has been working on this issue. Maybe she could enlighten us.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm a little frustrated by this whole discussion this morning. I don't mind telling you, because I'm trying to figure out, in the absence of any legislation, what you're all going to do about this. And it seems to me that I'm feeling like you need guidance here. And it's disappointing to me, frankly.
Madam Chair?
Yeah, Ms. Dixon?
Madam Chair, if I could say that as far as if I've ever been able to determine, the board has appreciated hearing about legislative concern on various issues and has addressed them. And in this case, I can say that I have never heard the board say that they would repeal the policy. I think my understanding was the issue was the way the policy came into being.
Fairness.
Madam Chair, that's kind of what the heart of the problem here is when the students came to me earlier this session, not only were they talking to me about the problem that they see before them, but in addition that I guess I would describe this as kind of the wheels are just spinning. There's no action being taken. And it sounds like I'm trying to figure out if that's really the case or not, and it must be the case if this is a concern that the board hasn't fully been apprised of. That's what it sounds to me like.
Madam Chair, the board is apprised that this at this time, and the point for me is that the students come before the board at every meeting, and the students did not raise this issue with the board. And it's difficult for me to understand why the students need to go to you to raise the issue without ever having brought it to the board. And since it went that way, since it went around the board, we welcome knowing that there is an issue. I think that's the point I'm trying to make. Had they, when they testified to the board, told us there was an issue, I cannot believe the board would not have addressed it.
Madam
Chair. Member, I think Mr. Lindler happens to be my constituent. He talks to me all the time about things that deal with higher ed and not with higher ed. I think Mr. Littler has the right, as my constituent, to tell me his concern. Now, he didn't talk about this because he wasn't in his position 2 years ago when we did this, but if my ears heard right,
The Board of Trustees doesn't think the students should come to the legislature with concerns without first going to the Board of Trustees. And again, I have election certificate. Mm-hmm. It says lawmaker, you know, and I guess I have the right to change laws. And when I see something that I think could be corrected to help the students, especially like credit creep, which I thought may have been a way to raise some money back in the top, again, not to blame MISU or the institutions or the campuses, but a way to raise a little more money because of the cuts, I thought I'd try to do something. And my legislation just directed the board to work with the teachers and the students and for them to come up with a policy, much like you've got, you know, on that one part in your bill where you direct the board to come up with a policy on
the labor issue.
Yeah, and the issue of whether we're producing, you know, mm-hmm. people or having classes and degrees that may not be relevant to whatever. So that's all I did. I'm sorry.
Well, and I think Mr. Littler and Mr. Graham did start their comments by saying they do want to work with the board. So I hope that can, you know, that attitude can continue.
Can I withdraw my proposal on that specific instance and backtrack on it?
What are you going to do? thank you. Mr. Whitman?
Madam Chair, members, if I may just briefly, I want to make it clear that students are willing to look at the repealer and are willing to accept that as long as we see commitment from the system that we will continue to address the concerns. There is a direct benefit to students to be had by asking programs to be transparent and provide the information about why those credits are necessary and making sure that students are not paying, you know, $140 average per credit to take classes that they may not necessarily need to be employed gainfully in their field. And we want to make sure that those concerns are addressed. We also want to make sure that the faculty's concerns are addressed, and that's why we worked very hard with them this session to bring forward some compromise language. However, if the legislature feels and if the conference committee feels that repealing this legislation is the best way to move forward, we're okay with that as long as we know that the system will be addressing our concerns as students and that we will be working in conjunction with the faculty to address their concerns about the quality of education and their ability to direct their curriculum.
And I just want to read at one point. Trustee did think that the students hadn't come to her, and I just want to say, you know, and I'm mostly here, so I'm not over there, so I don't know all the details, but the issue has been around since the end of 2007 legislative session. There was a committee that was formed within MINSCU to talk about this issue. So the issue has been around for several years.
Well, Madam Chair, I have to leave for that other committee, and we're supposed to wrap this up before you and I probably even get started. So I'm going to have Mr. Bly or Mr. Haas or one of them.
Bly can go.
Sit with you and what time are we meeting on Monday? Oh, that's my call.
No, you have tomorrow.
Oh. Okay, you can. What time are we meeting on Monday? You can have.
With Brian? Should we decide on Monday?
Wait, do you have Sunday then, and then I get Monday?
Sunday isn't included. Sunday's not included in the rules.
I'll give you Tuesday, too. Do I get something for
Probably earlier.
I think it is.
It's at caucus at 12:30 and session at 1.
10:30 it says on
here.
Probably earlier. I think it is.
It's at caucus at 12:30 and session at 1. So maybe we can do something like at 9.
Okay. In the morning?
Yeah.
And then come back. Yeah, I think 9 is good.
You can have a Tuesday too if I get a couple of items.
Just so we can come up with some progress, we come up with these kind of non-controversial languages for discussion. So if you're comfortable,
I will have my staff give them other things.
They're non-controversial. We can just talk about them.
Yeah.
this from my, you're not doing the
language. Yeah, I'm just about your language. Change the language.
Yeah, you want to do
okay.
That. I don't think so.
Okay, it's probably 9 o'clock. Show you the building.
Try to send us over there.
Okay.
John,
this is my name. I've got a few non-contacts for him to do.
Madam Chair.
Anything, guys?
No.
Madam Chair, anything different?
If our finance committee is closed later, we don't have...
Okay, I just have a few non-controversial language for discussion so that we can feel like we're making some decisions here. If the House conferees are comfortable, we just pass them out and we can just go through them and see what we want to do. Yeah, because I'm going to lose last, so I don't have three votes for my side. We can talk about some more things, so. Okay, so members have this little cheat sheet here. If we want to look at on page R3 and R4, the safety officers, survivors. Why did we want to do the Senate? Oh, great. I know how this is. Thank you. Okay. Members on the safety officer's language on page R3.
Oh, yeah.
So I believe this is right, Ms. Novak. The House language restricted to under age 23 for dependents.
And so the statute restricts that this is repeating what's in the statute.
Oh, in the rider.
In the rider. It's not new. It's not new. Okay. Because it's in the statute, it doesn't necessarily come to you.
Okay, so we want to do the House language.
Doesn't know.
What?
Madam Chair, I think we sent a law a couple years ago that some people can be 30 or under if they were in the military service, so that's why we took it out. So there is a technical reason to do it this kind of way.
Do we have to fix the statute somewhere else then?
Yeah.
Okay, so members, the policy issue then is the House is restricting the... They're not.
Yeah.
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 Right. This is okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll take the Senate. Sure, you can make a
motion. Yes.
I'll move that we accept the Senate language.
Okay. Lipson Blind moves the Senate language on the safety officer survivor 3.27 to 3.31. Any other questions or comments? Anyone in the audience want to comment? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Then on R5, the Indian Scholarship Rider language, I've heard from some tribal representatives, and they prefer the Senate language. Does the House have any
We're fine with that.
You're okay with that?
The Senate language.
Okay. Representative Hawes moves the Senate language on R5, 5.11 to 5.23. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. On page R9.
I don't think we have a preference here, do we? R1, 8.
But we're just moving the language.
One.
No, I'll move the Senate.
The Senate language is okay?
Yes.
And that is down forward.
Wait, just transfers, yeah.
Okay, allowing them to transfer. Okay, and Representative Blind moves the Senate language. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. We don't need it at all. We need to read it. Okay, and this is just the language of the House bill.
So, we'll move the Senate position, yeah.
Okay. Is everyone clear on that? R9 and R10, we don't need the reporting language.
Okay.
So it's just the Senate position. Representative Blind moves the Senate position. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. On RA2. Primary care education from HCAF. This is just a stylistic difference between the House and the Senate. One, we had noted primary care education initiatives that defines the activity. The other one defines the activity in the language, 12.21, 12.23.
I'll move the Senate.
So, President Blind moves the Senate on R18. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And on R25. Mr. Albrecht, do you want to describe the differences?
Madam Chair, on the House side, beginning on line 16.16, at the end of that line where it says all parties to, going through line 16.23, that portion of the House side corresponds to 17.11, the lower portion on the Senate side. Other than that, the language is the same.
Yeah, I think we prefer
that. Madam Chair, I couldn't hear, or Mr. Chair, I couldn't hear, Dennis. Could you say that again for a second?
Senator Lasky, on the House side, beginning on line 16.16, the sentence that begins all parties to, and going down to line 16.23, to the end of the sentence that includes June 30th, 2011, that portion of the House language is different from the Senate language that is addressing the same issue on 17.11 through 17.19.
And what is the difference in the language?
Mr. Chair and Senator Lass, I would defer to Senator Lynch to describe that.
Madam Chair and members, we had some discussion with Senate Counsel on this, and what we were trying to get at was we were trying to account for a situation where an allotment might be a reality, and we were trying to accommodate for that, so that in the case if an allotment would occur, that in essence this would be given some protection so that all parties would be very aware of any action that might be taken in that situation.
Madam Chair?
Senator Lass.
I'm just looking at the language. It seems to be on the House language refers to amount allocated to the partnership in that discrete section Mr. Albrecht explained, and the Senate language refers to the amount spent under the subdivision. Is that different choice of words of any significance there? You see what I'm referring to? The House language on 15.21 and the Senate language under 17.17.
Any staff say any?
Allocated versus spent?
I can make an argument, Madam Chair. I can make an argument that allocated is the number in the bill, whereas spent is only
what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Madam Chair, it sounds like the House language might be better from that standpoint, more precise.
Madam Chair and Senator Latch, we just asked members to give consideration to one of the things that we have encountered in the partnership is that there's an allocation made, and in this particular, how we got to this change actually was a situation where the allocation was made, but when reductions were necessary in the budget or when unallotments
are pending, if there were some dollars there that hadn't been expended, that was sort of viewed as an open checkbook, and we were that's problematic for the partnership because they are looking at this as a long-term sort of thing. They've got for example, they may have a researcher that's coming on board in 90 days. And so those dollars, while they are sitting there as not spent, they are most definitely accounted for.
Senator Lynch, I think that if both the House and the Senate, we agree with the intent. This is what will get us there. Ms. Novak.
Madam Chair and Senator Lynch, I think if you look on the House language on lines 16.15 through 16.23, the exact same language, essentially, except for the word allocated, is contained in that paragraph that provides consultation before any change in the funding to the partnership.
Madam Chair, Mayor Lynch, Ms. Novak, and really the communication component in this was really a key component to Representative Norton, Representative Liebling, and Representative Wolfe. And so with that, I think that we could take the House
language. Okay. And Senator Lynch moves the House language on R25, 16.11 to 16.29. Anybody in the audience want to comment? Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. That's what we had in our list. Did you have anything on your
list? Yes, Madam Chair. We'd like to see if we could bring up one of the person from the barber school, the accreditation problems to testify.
Okay. That's fine. What's your name?
Peggy Smith.
Peggy Smith. Ms. Smith.
Hello, members of the committee. My name is Peggy Schmidt, and I own and operate the Minnesota School of Barbering and have for the last 27 years. There is a new law that says that all small schools, all schools will have to be federally accredited by 2011. That's creating a huge hardship for my students. If I take the money that it costs to become federally accredited, which is about $30,000, plus you have to be audited by an outside auditor, which is about $6,000 a year, plus you have to have a visit from the federal government approving commission, it gets to be quite expensive. If I pass that expense on to the students, I don't see how the students are going to recover it by making us eligible for federal funds. So in other words, we won't be allowed to have any state grants for the students. None of the students will get state grants unless we get federally accredited. If we get federally accredited, we have to raise the tuition, so any money they may get from the Pell is going to be offset by the raise in tuition. And I just thought it was something that I should maybe talk about today.
Is Ms. Grimes here? I think we just talked about this a little bit yesterday.
Well, I would like to appeal that decision.
That's what this is. I should have gone to somebody else first. Mr. Chairman, sorry, Ms. Grimes, I'm going to lose my quorum here in a minute, so we can continue this discussion, but we can't make any more decisions. But I do want to pass out this 2021 amendment. This is something we discussed yesterday on the labor market data, and see if the... Can you just hold for a second? So we can make maybe one more decision. Are they working on one, too? Wait till Monday on this?
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll just pass this out. That's fine. And you can see what we've come up with, and then we'll talk about it on Monday. All right. Ms. Stanislaus needs to leave that. Okay, Ms. Grimes.
Madam Chair and members, in 2007, the legislature adopted language that said that as of July 1st, 2011, institutions participating in the state grant and Minnesota self-loan programs would need to be participating in the federal Pell Grant program. in order to continue to be able to participate in the state financial aid program. The idea was to have students applying for and receiving federal Pell Grants, because we subtract Pell Grants when calculating a state grant, even if the student doesn't actually get them. The students that are currently attending these institutions, many of them do not know that if they went to a different institution offering the same program, they would be eligible to receive a Pell Grant. In the case of Barber schools, if they went to Minneapolis Community and Technical College, they could get a Barber education and they would be getting a Pell Grant. While there are a number of small schools for whom this is clearly a hardship, there are also 11 cosmetology schools in Minnesota that have gone to the trouble and expense of becoming accredited and participating in the federal program, and their students do receive the federal Pell Grant.
Was it Smith?
There are two chairs at the Minneapolis Technical College. It's an 18-month program, and they have a 5-year waiting list. There are only 2 out of our schools in the state of Minnesota, and we each have 30 chairs of students. I don't think a student is going to wait 5 years to get into a program in order to get a Pell Grant. I think students have to have choices of whether they want to go to an 18-month program or whether they'd like to get in and out of our school in 9 months and maybe start generating some income. Why would you go to a school that takes twice as long? The idea is to get into school, get out of school, and start making some money behind the chair. We have a couple schools in the prison, and that's pretty much it. There are 27 schools in the state of Minnesota
that are going to be affected by this.
There are not just beauty schools and barber schools. There are taxidermy schools and truck driving schools and guiding schools. There are other schools
that are going to be
affected. I think this is about making choices.
A student has a choice.
I think they have a choice to
decide what school they want to. Perhaps they don't want to go to the Minneapolis
Technical College. Perhaps they want to go to our school instead, or the other barber school.
Or a beauty school.
We delay them.
And does not have federal funding.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms.
Schmidt.
What is it that you need from us?
What I need from you in the Walgreens world would be to eliminate the federal accreditation criteria in order for us to get state grants and cell phones. Right now we participate in state grants and we participate in the cell phone program. When this law goes through, we will not be eligible. None of the students will be eligible for Pell Grants, state grants, or state loans.
They will be eligible for
absolutely nothing.
I think the problem that we're having is that we had this discussion 4 years ago, and we did a 4-year implementation. It's 4 years of planning, and now we're down to, you know, kind of do or die. And you're asking for not only a delay, but to reverse the policy. So I think that's kind of the problem that we're having. Senator Sharon.
My question was,
you're talking about the cost to small schools. If you become eligible for the
Is that a one-time cost?
Ms. Smith? I'm sorry, I have to call your name for purposes of the tape because we're recording. In fact, you identify who's talking.
Chairman, board. The first
thing is, of course, the most expensive, and that's just $30,000 to start out with.
And then you have to
support the federal
accreditation, which means you have to hire more staff to help you do that. Plus, you have to be audited, which is very, very expensive to have an independent auditor come in and audit books. I think one of the motivations is, I don't think the state would have to come in and audit us, which they do it now, of course. I mean, they come in and they audit our books, and all the support we get from the state now
is at no cost
to the school or the students.
So it initially it cost a lot, but it also cost a lot as we go down the road. Now, bear in mind, we only have 30 chairs in the school.
The most we could ever have at one time is 30 students.
The most the other Bible school could have at one time is
30 students. The Minneapolis Technical School only has
30 students. That's only 90 barbers. That's not enough.
They need to, if you do this, the this goes in, I don't know what
the future of my school is going to be. I don't know what the future of the other school is going to be.
Because right now, today, there's only 15
students in my school. 15 really good students who are going to be really good haircutters.
But
still only 15.
Are we facing a, is this going to be a workforce shortage issue, cosmetologists and barbers?
Well,
I hadn't heard that.
Right now,
not cosmetologists.
See all these people unemployed.
All the cosmetologists.
I have probably 30 jobs for every barber that graduates from my school.
Everybody's crying about not having a job.
If you're a barber or a hairdresser, you can get, I could get a bazillion jobs from
everybody. Needs service.
So when people are getting dislocated, now we have
dislocated worker funding. These people can
get a dislocated worker, get
fully funded,
they're back in the workforce in 9 months and loving cutting hair. And there's jobs for them. And it doesn't matter what color they are, what sex they are, what nationality they are,
what language they speak, I can get them all a job.
Madam Chair.
Representative Black.
I'm just wondering if there's, Ms. Grimes, if there's a way, it does seem like a special case. Is there a way to work something out with the barber schools that might make it more affordable for them to get this?
Mr. Chair, the Office of Higher Education has no control over what the accrediting agencies charge to become accredited, nor do we have any control over the occasions on which the federal auditors come and decide to audit somebody and that the school then has to pay for. We did have a conference last fall. We have been trying to answer questions and provide information about what it takes to get accredited and what it takes to participate. It's a difficult issue. There are at least 6, probably more like 10 campuses that, because the legislation passed that said it was going to be implemented 4 years down the road, have gone to the expense, are in the process of going through the expense of becoming accredited because the law is sitting there saying it will be in effect July 1st, 2011.
I have one question, Ms. Smith. Ms. Grimes, how much money are students losing, would you estimate, because they're not getting a Pell Grant?
My recollection is that $900,000 for the group of students that attend these schools. So our estimate is that they would get at least $900,000 in Pell Grants if this school were...
So Ms. Smith commented that she would have to raise her tuition, which would cost the students more, might end up being a wash, but... In the end, if the public policy is that we want these schools to be certified, you know, it's kind of hard now, 4 years later, to start making exceptions when we already did a 4-year waiver. Ms. Smith.
Madam Chairman, I want to state now, too, that I have had federal accreditation. In 1989, I did go through the federal accreditation process. We were given
health guaranteed student loans, and if you take one, you take them all.
Out of 4 of the guys that took out student
loans, 3 of them defaulted on a student loan.
I was put on probation, suspension. Oh, my name was all over the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Minnesota School of Barbering had a
default rate in Minnesota, 75% default rate. Was that correct?
Yes, it was. 3 guys
didn't pay back the student loan. 1 guy did.
I had a flash of 15. Mm-hmm. Now I don't even have federal accreditation, which means all the students would suffer because 3 guys didn't pay back their loans. It's a loaded gun. I've been there.
Representative Hawks, did you have your...
No,
okay.
I passed.
Senator Lynch. You're thinking about that loaded gun thing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm thinking about the language that appears in the House on this issue, and it's on R10, and I was listening to what Ms. Grimes has said, and I'm listening to what Ms. Smith has said, and I would just suggest that I'm not, regardless of where you are on this issue, I would just offer that I'm not sure that the language in the bill addresses this situation.
Because so it does sound like the office has been working with to try to identify cost-effective methods to achieve accreditation. But what Ms. Smith is saying, she doesn't want accreditation.
I'm not saying I don't want accreditation, Madam Chair. What I'm saying is I don't think we can afford accreditation.
Yeah.
There's a difference because
we have been accredited.
Mm-hmm.
They do have wonderful policies. And as a matter of fact, we still follow most of the policies that they taught us when they come in and federally accredited us. But they're going to take it away the first time 3 guys don't pay a loan.
And I do have
Ms. Grimes.
Trisha Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. I do want to provide one point of clarification. The language that's in statute says that the institutions have to start participating in the federal Pell Grant program. It does not say they have to participate in the federal loan program.
Mm-hmm.
They should choose not to participate in the federal loan program. So
But in order to participate in the Pell Grant, you have to get accredited,
and you have to go through the federal government's process. Yeah.
Okay, any other comments or questions on this? Sandwich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for the record, Ms. Grimes testified when we met earlier that with regard to the language before us, that my recollection is that basically you said, I'm not sure what else we could do to offer further support.
Madam Chair, Senator, we are certainly going to continue to work with the institutions. We don't have a big problem with the House language. We were actually looking for a little guidance about what more it is that people would like us to do.
Right. Okay, thank you very much, and thank you, Ms. Smith, for coming today. We'll noodle on this a little bit.
Put the gun away.
That's a technical term.
Well, I'm kind of short of conference here, so and I think there's a lot of work the staff needs to be doing on other bills. So we will adjourn, and there will be no meeting tomorrow. And I'll be chair again on Sunday. We'll convene at 9 a.m.
Monday?
I'm sorry. Yes, not Sunday. Monday at 9 a.m. Conference committee is adjourned.